the country you hope to find, you know, while you're on a road trip or something. You're not just hearing the same stuff on the streaming platforms, whatever, and you get to hear what's here. You get to hear what came here before, and it's really great. It's an education that everybody needs to hear these incredible songs. It's just an amazing opportunity for local and regional musicians.
Listen for his music and other independent artists here on KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT Houston, and also as a podcast out there in the digital realm. I am Brett Cullum, and in this edition, I talk to Reverend Neil G. Thomas, the senior pastor of Cathedral of Hope of Dallas, about an editorial that was published in the New York Times slamming the word queer. It seems Matthew Vines has come out as gay, but not queer, and in the process, alienated a lot of the community. We are proud to be Queer Voices because we think it encompasses everyone. After that, I talk with author R. Lee Ingalls about what it's like to be related to Laura Ingalls Wilder now that a new Netflix series is rebooting Little House on the Prairie. And finally, I talk with Reese Carter about what it's like to be a non-binary performer in the tour of Moulin Rouge, which hits the Hobby Center July 14th as part of the Broadway at the Hobby Center series. Queer Voices, we include everyone, all the letters, and we start now. Hi there, this is Brett Cullum, and on June 30th, Matthew Vines published an editorial in the New York Times saying that he doesn't like using the word queer over being called gay. Now, Matthew wrote a book called God and the Gay Christian, The Biblical Case in Support of Same-Sex Relationships. He grew up in Wichita and moved to Dallas. And today, I am joined by Reverend Neil G. Thomas. He is the senior pastor of Cathedral Hope of Dallas. And we're going to talk about words and why they matter. So thank you, Neil, for being here.
I'm grateful to be here, Brett. Thank you very much indeed for the invitation.
Well, tell me a little bit about you and what you do first so that we get some context of who Neil Thomas is.
Well, as you can probably tell from my accent, I wasn't raised in Dallas. I'm actually from the United Kingdom, was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon tradition. And my mom and dad got divorced when I was 2 years old, and my mom got the church and dad didn't. And so we were raised, one of seven kids in the Mormon tradition. I tell that as a context because we left the Mormon tradition, but not because I came out as a gay man, because my mom wanted to remarry and he was not a Mormon. I realized at a very early age, probably around 7, 8, 9 years of age, that the church could be wrong. And that was a very valuable lesson for when I later came out as a gay man. We'd left the Mormon tradition, but I never left my faith. And my faith remained with me. I went to seminary when I was 18, graduated when I was 23, and became a pastor in the United Kingdom. And for the last 30-something years now, I've pastored predominantly LGBT congregations or congregations that were made up or founded in the LGBT movement.
And your current congregation is large.
Known as the largest predominantly LGBT congregation in the world. We're about 4,000 members, roughly about 1,000 on a Sunday morning. And so, it's a great congregation. And in the middle of the Bible Belt, has been here for 56 years now.
You know, it's always a struggle to retain your spirituality when you enter the queer community. There's a lot of trepidation about that. So it's always great to see somebody who's really retained their faith and made it a practice. So very interesting. But now tell me a little bit about how you came to be aware of Matthew Vines and why he's kind of a voice that we know about.
Yeah, Matthew wrote an amazing book. And it was a transformational book called God and the Gay Christian. And, you know, he comes from a more evangelical background. Those of us who have perhaps been more mainline, a little ahead of the evangelical church, certainly have done a lot of work around the six clobber passages that are often used and quoted by scripture. And Matthew wrote this incredible book that, you know, I've referenced on many, many occasions and have used in classes and seminaries, building on a lot of the work that had been done before, but using this within an evangelical context, which has certainly helped many, many people to be able to reconcile their sexuality and their faith and to a broader understanding of what it means to be God and the gay Christian. And it's been a revolutionary book. He released a subsequent version of that book, I think, just in the last year or so, and has led what's called the Reformation Project, which has also had its own evolution over the many years. Talking about Side A and Side B and working with evangelical churches and that evangelical space to help people reconcile their sexuality and their spirituality. It's an amazing piece of work. And Matthew has contributed quite widely to helping to create and heal that divide.
Yeah. Well, this piece for the New York Times, the title of it is I'm Gay, Not Queer, It Matters. And in it, in essence, he's saying that the queer is a word that we should avoid because it undermines his sense of same-sex marriage rights, that conservative Christians are going to use the inclusiveness of that term to take some rights back from the community. And what is it that makes that such a loaded opinion? And why is it kind of like not something that we really should reconcile at this point?
Well, yeah, I think that's an interesting question, Brett. And of course, you know that the article itself has caused quite a lot of controversy and conversation, and probably a very valuable conversation to be had. Matthew can certainly speak for himself. And you know, if he'd just used I statements throughout this entire piece, probably would not have had such a reaction. But what it appears to be is that he is drawing some lines around who is in and who is out, what should be included and what is not included. And I think that that is problematic because there is a reality that for many of us, myself included, that the use of the word queer is not something that perhaps was used in the 50s, 60s, but really has taken on a definition of understanding queer and queerness as those of us who have done the work of standing against a dominant culture, standing against a binary system that led to the exclusion of LGBT people in the church in the first place. And that whilst I understand that there has been a shift recently, especially here in the United States, about the ways in which marriage equality is being viewed amongst the evangelical tradition, the reality is that that was going to happen regardless of what words we used. Anyone who's observed liberation movements understands that the pendulum often gets swung in the other direction when rights are being achieved and movement continues to happen. But to symbolize that, or just to suggest that somehow this use of the word queer is the reason for that, is very problematic. When I understand, and I think most of us who are the beneficiaries of those who led the queer movement and gay liberation movements, completely understand that anything that wants us to be respectable or quiet or silenced will never bring about liberation. It will never bring about full inclusion. And that once a movement is on its way, one has to embrace that these movements have always sought to break down the very systems that were used to shut us out. And that just using the word gay, which of course doesn't include lesbians and bisexuals and the other parts of our alphabet, suddenly says that it's on my terms only. And Matthew and I benefited from the work of people we've stood on their shoulders, who have always blurred those lines and moved those lines forward. And so I think that this has been, I think that Matthew's buying into respectability and assimilation, which is never about movement.
Yeah, well said. And it's definitely a controversial term. I mean, even our show, Queer Voices, we get a lot of pushback from people that associate that with a more negative connotation, like you mentioned in the 50s and 60s, when it was certainly a term that was not used favorably. And famously, Queer Nation kind of reclaimed it as a rebellion kind of a move when they were in the 80s and trying to do that. So, and it really does mean something, I think, different. I think language evolves, and it's interesting to see how it's become a more inclusive idea. And I certainly use it myself a lot to embrace the entire community, because I feel like we do need to all come together rather than saying this is the gatekeeping and this, like you said, who belongs and who doesn't. But now, in his opinion piece, he cited that the support for same-sex marriage has dropped 18 percentage points. And I wanted to kind of parse that a little bit. Overall, in the general population, it's estimated that about 65% approve. And this is according to a Gallup poll that was done in June. And that is down from a high of about 71% in 2022, 2023, around that era. So overall, it hasn't dropped as dramatically as what he's stating in this piece. But what he is actually worried about and what he's citing is that we've seen this in conservative groups such as Republicans. They went from about a 55% percentage down to 37%. So there's his 18. And that's why he's saying he is worried about the rights. Is it something that you're seeing that people are concerned about in the church? Or is it, I mean, is it something that's talked about in religious communities? This could be a sway, something that would endanger this?
Well, Brett, let's be honest. The church has always been and should always be countercultural. It should always be the moral voice of and the moral conscience of people. I mean, that's what religion does. And what we are also witnessing at the same time is a rise of a Christian nationalism and the rise of a Christian identity that is anything but Christian, certainly not the ways of Jesus. There is no way that you can read the Beatitudes of Jesus and support the moral fabric of our society, predominantly within the more conservative wing of the church, that says that immigrants are not welcome, that says that women should have no place in the pulpit. You know, so this swing is not just about LGBT people or even the queer movement. It's about a rise of Christian nationalism that wants to define who is in and who is out. And the church should always be the countercultural voice to that. And so I'm not surprised that conservatives and evangelicals have lost or losing some level of support for marriage equality, but they're losing levels of support for anything that is seen as the ways of Jesus. So I would say, and we're certainly seeing it in more mainline traditions, the United Methodist Church just recently voting to include LGBT clergy specifically among their ranks and to remove the language of homosexuality from their book of discipline. You know, there are two movements going on. And I want to be on the movement that is always about radical inclusion. I wrote my doctoral dissertation in 2008, I believe, called Queer Theology and Introduction, building on the foundations of queer theory. And in there, I acknowledge that the word queer is problematic. It's a problematic word because of its history. And I cite at the very end of my doctoral piece that the whoever takes on this next job or if they're writing another piece, the piece should be called Toward a Theology of Radical Inclusion. And I think that's what I understand when we use this word queer, is that it really is about who is left out and how do we ensure that this faith, this church, this body that we talk about is always looking to extend the table, not to restrict it, not to say that because now I'm at the table, nobody else can get there, or only people who look like me or think like me or preach like me or even theologize like me can have a place at the table. That we should always be extending that table beyond our own identities. And who's left behind? So I think that to correlate this with only evangelical Christianity is looking short of where the movement of evangelical Christianity is moving, and that is to include less and not to include more.
One of the biggest dividers right now in our country is the perception of the morality of changing or correcting one's gender. And is there anything even remotely biblical about this? I mean, where does this kind of opinion come from a standpoint of that in religion?
Again, you know, what we're seeing in the United States right now is that no one's doing any critical analysis of Scripture and contextualizing exactly where Scriptures were written, for what period, for who. You know, anyone who's done anything around English literature knows that social location is absolutely fundamental. Social location of the writer, social location of the reader, social location of the actual piece that we find ourselves reading from whatever period. And very often, critics or those who examine Scripture forget to contextualize where it's coming from. Now, if we talk about, you know, transphobic in specific, you know, one can cite some Old Testament Scriptures around eunuchs, you know, who are, you know, often referred to, especially in our modern culture, as some might say, you know, castrated males who have changed their gender and who are, But the reality is Jesus extends the thought of what a eunuch is. In Jesus' own writings, he talks about eunuchs who were born that way, made that way by humanity, and some who have renounced marriage for the glory of God. And so Jesus is seen to extend this table over and over and over again. And who am I to say that what a transgender experience is? My role as a person of faith is to embrace, to come with compassion and with understanding, and to seek equality, to find places at the table. And so it makes some people uncomfortable. The word queer makes some people uncomfortable, but that doesn't mean that I have the right to say that it's not valid or included or a part of. And the church is going to make people uncomfortable. Language is going to make people uncomfortable, but that doesn't give me the right, or anybody else, to say that the table's now closed.
I'm talking to Reverend Neil G. Thomas, senior pastor of Cathedral Hope of Dallas. I really love this idea of moving religion towards radical inclusion, or moving theology towards that. It seems that that is the place that I would love to go. And certainly I've embraced the word queer as one part of my identity and part of the identity of the show. So I appreciate you coming on and talking about why this idea of somebody saying that that term is not going to describe them, you know, is a little bit divisive, obviously. But just so that we can know where to reach out to you if somebody has any questions or anything further, obviously, you're a senior pastor of Cathedral Hope of Dallas. Should be pretty easy to find on the internet, but is there a website or?
Yeah, cathedralofhope.com is our website. We also stream all our worship services. And of course, you know, please do connect with me. I guess I also want to just say, Brett, that in no way do I judge or demonize Matthew Bynes. I know Matthew. We live in the same city. We've sat at many, many tables together. He has offered a great value to the Christian church, and specifically in the evangelical movement. I also want to acknowledge I'm a white male cisgender gay guy. And, you know, I don't speak for other communities, but I also want to acknowledge that, and I want to put it this way, you know, during the AIDS pandemic, we faced very similar backlashes. There was the ACT UPs and there was the traditional gays who wanted ACT UP to be silent, felt that it was the wrong strategy. It was not the right way. What we've come to learn over by looking back in hindsight is that without the ACT UP movement and without those who wanted to be respectable, we would have had a much, much bigger pandemic, both in the United States and around the world. And in some ways, both are needed. And I think my main disagreement, if you will, with this particular article is that it's one way or the other. It's one identity or the other. And the truth of the matter is, in any social change, in any Christian change, both have been essential to respect one another. And Matthew doesn't need to call himself queer, but that doesn't give him right to say that I can't.
Very well said. And certainly it's a piece that has sparked a lot of conversation and probably much needed within the community to have these thoughts about semantics and where we are and where we want to be moving forward. So
queer movement is more than just LGBT. You know, that anyone who stands against dominant culture has the right to find themselves in this queer movement and to ask themselves this fundamental question. And I think I'll end with this, is that we have to understand that the binaries were put there for a reason. And we are discovering that the binaries did not, will not, and cannot work. And so we're in a period of complete change, which is not only going to make very people uncomfortable, but it's going to also bring out people who want to be entrenched in their side. And I think that's the polarization that we're seeing in our country right now. Queer people are a great scapegoat, but we've also always been the great change makers. So I would encourage us to keep on doing that work.
Definitely. Cheers to change. Definitely. Thank you so much, Neil Thomas.
Thank you, Brett.
This radio program, Queer Voices, has existed since the 1970s on KPFT. We have this little crew of folks working every week to produce what's no longer unique, because we're almost mainstream now, but we're still an important voice that might not otherwise get heard because it's not on that many places. So KPFT is very important to give voices to those who might not otherwise have voices. So as Glenn always says, you participate by listening. You should also participate by supporting the station. So please go to kpft.org and make your donation right away.
Hi there, this is Brett Cullum, and Netflix is going to reboot Little House on the Prairie on July 9th. and they are going to drop all 8 episodes of their first season on that date. Now, the book series by Laura Ingalls Wilder was largely published in the 30s and 40s. The television show ran from 1974 to 1983, and the television show loosely followed the books Little House on the Prairie and On the Banks of Plum Creek. They sort of combined them so that the Ingalls were moving to Walnut Grove, Minnesota. Now, Michael Landon kept them in one spot during the entire show, whereas the books were set in many locations. As the books changed, so did the locations of the home. So truly, about 40 years between each iteration, so time for another one. There are decidedly no queer characters in Little House, but my spouse is author R. Lee Ingalls, so it would be strange not to bring this topic up with him. So he is a contributor on Queer Voices, also an author, and I thought we could talk about some Little House things. So welcome, Lee.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, just to bring everyone up to speed, I know this is the one question you dread getting asked every time, but how are you related to Laura Ingalls Wilder?
Yeah, well, I don't so much dread it, but it is absolutely the first question I get whenever somebody makes that connection. So it's easiest to understand if you look at her family first. So Laura is one of four girls for Charles and Carolyn, four girls that lived to adulthood. The only son didn't live to adulthood. So of those four girls, only one of them had their own child, and that was Laura. She had a daughter named Rose, who grew up to be quite an accomplished writer and author on her own. But Rose only had one child. That child did not survive infancy. And because of complications from that pregnancy, she was never able to have any more children. So the net is the four girls, there are no direct descendants of them, which means also for Charles and Carolyn, there are no living direct descendants either. You have to look to a sibling. And my great-great-grandfather is Lansford James Ingalls. He's Charles' younger brother.
So basically, a brother of the character that we're seeing on Little House on the Prairie.
Exactly. Pop, yes.
Or in the books.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So when did you realize you were first connected? When did that kind of hit home?
Yeah. So it kind of happened by mistake. I was still in grade school and we were living in Wisconsin. Somebody came up to me in the schoolyard and ask, are you the same family as the Little House on the Prairie? You spell your last name the same way. And I didn't know. So I went home and I asked my mother, and she said, yes, in fact, we are, but she wasn't exactly sure how. So yeah, that's how I found out.
So what did you think of the original Michael Landon TV series when it came out? Like, what was your family's reaction to that?
So we all got a set of the books when the series first came out, and I still have that set of books today. In fact, I've never even opened them. It's kind of surreal to know that a series is being produced based on your family's history. So that was kind of it was really an odd feeling. I liked the show. I was working at the time, and a lot of times I was working in the evenings, so I wasn't able to watch the series completely, but I did see the episodes. I thought they did a great job. I thought the series stuck to some of the foundational themes of Laura's works. So I was glad to see that.
The interesting thing about this new project with Netflix is that they are claiming that Rebecca Sonnenschein, who is the showrunner, is taking all of this back to the books rather than what Michael Landon did. Now, what Michael Landon did was probably a product of his time. To do a TV show then, they wanted to keep one set.
Right.
They didn't want them to move around. But now we have the ability, obviously, with these streaming services, that each season can be its own thing. So I think it sounds like Rebecca is going to try to go back to the books rather than rebooting the Michael Landon series.
Right. And as you know, that's more true to our family generally, because my first book, each chapter is set in a different house. We moved around a lot, as did Laura's family.
Yeah, you guys seem to have that in your genetics.
Yes, we do.
I don't know why, but so how has the series, I mean, either the books or the television show, influenced your life?
You know, like I said, it's been a very surreal experience. A lot of times, and well, in fact, when we first got together, I kind of told you about that relationship, and I don't think you took it seriously at the time, but I said, you'll be surprised how often this comes up in conversation, and people will bring it up, and that has happened. So every once in a while, someone made the connection between my name and the author, and when they found out that I was actually part of that family, and then, of course, you get a series of questions. And so outside of that, though, I don't really think it's influenced my life, except maybe in the collecting of our family memorabilia. I seem to do that more than most people I know.
Yeah, but that kind of just came about naturally, I guess.
Right. Because my mother and father did that. So did my grandparents.
Yeah. And to be fair, when we did first meet, I did immediately kind of ping that. I was like, oh, Ingalls. Okay. And I grew up reading the books. And I grew up watching the show. And I think that I was of an age when the TV series came out that it was like must-see TV for me. And I think that my generation kind of really did that. I think it's interesting to see what is happening with this new Netflix series. What are you hoping that this new incarnation of Little House will do?
Yeah, so I'm hoping that it will introduce the series to a new generation. That's the net of what I actually hope to see. So another generation of Americans seeing those stories, bringing them to life, and you know, being the same thing in their childhood that the original series was for people that when you were a child.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of like fear, I think, from the original fans coming around and with this Netflix reboot. Do you understand their kind of qualms about that? Or
I do. The thing that I don't understand is how a judgment can be made about something you haven't even seen.
Yeah.
So that part I struggle with. But, you know, I understand what their fear is, that they're going to make it something other than what it was originally, take it out of the time period that it was actually took place for Laura and her family. I get all of that. But the realities of our society, you know, they've changed. They've evolved. And the show should evolve as well.
Well, it's interesting because I think that both the books and the original series with Michael Landon came out at times when they were needed, if you will. The books obviously came out in the time around the Great Depression, the first book.
Yes.
And it was to be thankful for what you have. I think that that was a driving thing. And then in the 70s, there was this kind of feeling of mistrust. I think Richard Nixon was president and Michael Landon kind of gave this family that you could kind of believe in and trust.
Yeah.
So what do you think this, I mean, you had to speculate. We haven't seen the show yet, but what would you think that it's trying to say today?
If they stay true to the actual writing. So again, the, you know, some of the foundational pieces of Laura's works were honesty, integrity, and doing the right thing. And they were also seeming very wholesome stories as well. And I think that's so needed today. We don't have a lot of that. So I think people need to see that or have that in their lives again. So that's I'm hopeful that it will take hold because of that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And it's an interesting division of the fans, I think, because we have gone to quite a few fan events and you have gone on your own to quite a few fan events as well. Things like the home sites and different conventions. And we've gone to like casts, you know, where you get to meet some of the cast and things like that.
Right.
So what is it like for you to be queer or to be a gay man from the Ingalls family and trying to relate to this very conservative fan base and kind of talk to them?
Yeah. So it gets back to something I said very frequently, and that is there's a duality in our life that we have to figure out and make work. So you're right. When I go into those environments, I don't try to hide who I am. I'm not, you know, I'm proud that we are married and we're a couple. However, I don't bring that to the forefront. You know, I understand the audience that I'm there to, you know, address and the message that they're expecting from me. So, and I try to be respectful of that. And there's a lot of people that are there that know that we're a couple and that we're together. They have no problem with it, but it's just not a part of my life that they're interested in. So I don't really try to force that on them. So that is, you know, part of it.
Well, what I think is amusing though, is we have run into several LGBTQIA+ folks who do relate so much to Little House on the Prairie.
I know.
It is kind of an interesting paradox there. It's almost like country music and LGBTQIA+ people.
Yeah.
But now you started a nonprofit this year for the Society of the Ingalls Family.
Right.
What's the purpose and the focus of that?
So coming out, the one strength of Laura Ingalls Wilder's works is she told the stories of an average American family living in extraordinary times in our nation's history. And I think that's the strength of her works. What I have come to realize, especially after writing a couple of books, that the stories of the average American don't often get told. And a couple of generations go by, and now the details of your life are largely forgotten. People don't recognize you anymore in photos. And there are a good number of us that live average lives that have extraordinary events happen during those lives, and it's a shame to lose that. So the focus of it is to gather those stories, gather that memorabilia, and make it available in some format to future generations. That's the actual purpose. So it's Society of the Ingalls Family, but you know, in that statement, we're viewing the Ingalls family as representative of the average American family, not just our family.
Well, speaking of the average American family and your family, tell me about the first book that you wrote. What was that?
So the first book that I wrote was Ingalls on the Prairie, the Gene and Fern Ingalls story. It's the story of my parents' early years.
Okay. And that kind of chronicled their history, is that?
Yeah. So the intent was, you know, as I went through my life, you know, I knew that at some point in time, somebody was going to pick up the pen, so to speak, and write about our family again. And as time went on and nobody was doing it, at some point it occurred to me that that might have to be me. So then I started jotting down memory joggers, the stories within our own family that would be interesting, actually stories in my life that would be interesting. And my thought was to write my story. But as I began that, I quickly realized the story that should have been told is my grandparents, but I didn't have enough detail of their life to actually write a book about them. But I did have enough detail about my parents, and their lives were equally as interesting. As you know, I mean, a huge number of events that really set them apart from other people. And I didn't want that to pass without being told for future generations.
And then you followed that up with another book.
And I did. Then I actually wrote my story. A lot of the storylines that I had originally intended to put in my book were in the first book, so I didn't really go into the same amount of detail. But, you know, for me, growing up as a gay man, born in the mid-1900s, and living in a time where adults in your life absolutely controlled the materials that you had access to. So there's only three television stations, magazines and books and all those kind of things they could easily keep away from you so that you don't really know that there are other people like you in the world. So you grow up in this really lonely space. And the first part of the book was so desperate and dark. And I thought, oh man, I have to do something to lighten this up a little bit or I won't be able to get through it. So I did. Then I wrote the preface to the book, which then kind of gave some hope. And I could, you know, as I'm writing about those really desperate times, see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, you know, there's an old saying, it gets better. I mean, that was a whole campaign. Yeah. As we grow up, we probably get a little bit more comfortable in our just our identity as a queer community.
Right, right. Yeah. It does. And it did get better for me. And the other thing that was a popular phrase during the 1990s was, we are everywhere. And that was part of the catalyst for writing this book as well. We are everywhere, including one of the families that is most well-known in our country.
Yeah. And what is the second book called?
Second book is called The Prairie Has a Rainbow.
And then is there any other books that you've written? Or?
Yeah. So I've written a couple short stories. I've also written a cookbook. So my family worked on a cookbook back in the early 2000s, and it was so thick, I never really did anything with it. But recently, I took out some of the best recipes, those that I use all the time. I made a smaller cookbook out of it. So yeah, it's Cooking on the Prairie with the Ingalls.
So you've got your mom and dad story, you've got yours, you've got a cooking story.
Yes.
Okay, so where can we get these? I mean, what?
Okay, so you can find them on Amazon.
Okay.
You can look under my name, Arlie Ingalls, the author, and the old books will be listed there, as well as the short stories.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm super excited to actually get to watch this Netflix show with you. And are you planning any events or anything like that?
Yeah. So we do have two events that are planned around it. So we decided to do a watch party. And when I say we, the Society of the Ingalls Family decided to do a watch party, but there was already one scheduled and had been advertised for the 9th. So we didn't want to have a conflict with that one. So we moved ours to the 10th, which did a couple of things, kind of took the pressure off from everybody watching it that first night. And second, some of the celebrities like Alison Arngrim, the twins that played Rose Wilder, Sydney Greenbush played Carrie. They will be attending our event. Yeah.
No, that's amazing. And if somebody wants to attend this event, where are they going to go to find out about it?
So you can go to send me a note on Facebook, Lee Ingalls or R. Lee Ingalls, or you can send an email to societyoftheingallsfamily@gmail.com.
Okay. So what's next for you? I mean, what are you planning after this? I mean, obviously, this is going to be a big to-do, but anything that kind of more personal that you're working on as projects?
I have a couple of things that I'm working on. You know, I wrote for a magazine for how many years? A couple of years. And that kind of went away. And I thought, you know, I still like to write, so I'm going to put my articles out online. So I created two websites. One is America's Fabric. That is where I pretty much stay true to the Ingalls family. Most articles there are written about family type topics. I also created one called The Mansion Men, which is more socially forward. It's where I put those storylines that are more appropriate for our group of people.
And you realize the irony of this is that Rose Wilder actually wrote for magazines. Right. So she also wrote books.
Yes.
But it was kind of interesting that
it's
they
in
all
her blood.
Did. Yeah, there you go. You're just fulfilling your destiny here for Ingalls. So there you go. Well, I'm very excited to see Little House come up. I'm very excited to see it for a new generation. I'm very curious to see what they do. The speculation is that they're going to stick more to the books, which from what I can tell, looks like they're going to start with Little House on the Prairie because they're going to move to Indian territory from what I can tell from the previews. But you have to understand, when we recorded this, we haven't seen an episode.
Right.
At all.
We have not seen anything. Yeah. Outside the trailers.
We could be totally wrong.
Yeah. Although I have to agree with you, all the research that you've done, which you're excellent at, kind of points to that.
Yeah, well, let's hope, but it should be interesting. So yes. Congratulations on your family once again being chronicled, this time with the streaming service Netflix. So hopefully it'll be huge, and hopefully you'll get a lot more opportunities to talk about your family. And then one of the things I think is interesting is that when you talk about your family, it usually inspires other people.
Always. When I talk to people about it or they come up and talk to me, I'll have a little bit to say about mine. And then they start telling me about their family. And that's kind of what put me on the path. Everybody has interesting stories. Write them down.
Yeah. No, and I would encourage that for our community as well. I mean, the queer community. You think about all of the drag families and stuff like that. They need their own history.
Yes, they do.
Because that's how long before that becomes gone.
50 years from now, people will be very interested in knowing what our lives were like.
Yes.
We just have to write it down.
And the irony is, they're called houses.
Yes.
Absolutely right about it. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there. This is Brett Cullum. And today I'm joined by Reese Carr, who is making their national tour debut as part of the cast of the touring production of Moulin Rouge, which comes as part of the Broadway at the Hobby Center series, July 14th through the 19th. They are a graduate of Ohio University's inaugural musical theater class and also the co-founder of Vibrancy Theater. Welcome, Reese.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Well, the biggest question that I always wonder with people in this particular tour or this show, were you familiar with Moulin Rouge before you auditioned?
As for the musical, yes. I remember I was in school at OU and Moulin Rouge had like just been coming out. And I remember seeing a few clips from like rehearsals and things. But then I remember seeing several performances on like Good Morning America. And I remember there was one specifically that was on the Tony Awards. And I remember watching that and being like, wow, that is incredible. And even listening to some of the music from it, I had never seen Moulin Rouge, the movie, before I booked the job. I'll be very transparent about that. And so coming into the musical, I was like, wow, this looks so cool. And I think it was, I had watched several clips before. It was at a time where I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford a ticket to this show. Actually, living in Ohio, I grew up in Ohio. And so Broadway shows were all, I had to be very specific and particular about which ones I was able to see and which ones I chose to see. And so Moulin Rouge came at a time where I wasn't really able to necessarily go to New York and see it before I was even able to move there. But, you know, in the age of TikTok, YouTube, I found a way to watch clips and to watch whatever it was I needed to watch. And so, but there came a time clearly after I had graduated school when I was like, Moulin Rouge is on my list of shows I want to do. It's on at the, it was in the top three, whether Broadway or tour. And I certainly did not expect tour. I didn't expect tour of anything really, but specifically Moulin Rouge, that was a really big surprise. And what I will say, going into my audition for the show, I had felt like I had already seen it, especially like I'd watched several clips of like different choreography moments. And I had a really good understanding of what it required and what it was asking. And so when the audition came, I felt very much like, oh, okay, great. If I don't get it, fine. But I feel pretty prepared for not having seen it. And now that I've seen the movie, I understand the hype around it. What I will say, the movie is wild. I did not expect the movie to be what it is. And so seeing the musical, I was like, wow, this feels very different in a good way.
It is very different. I distinctly remember it coming out in 2001. And I went and saw it opening weekend, like, three or four times. It was like crazy. I was just like, I had never seen anything like it. I don't think I've seen anything since, unless you really count some other films from Baz Luhrmann, like Strictly Ballroom or something like that. But it is very unique. And I know that Baz was actually involved in making this and kind of coming back with this on Broadway and stuff in the tour. So what's it like to be part of this cast? I mean, how big is this cast, for first of all? It's got to be huge, right?
I want to say about, if we're counting also swings off stage and on stage, I want to say it's about 30-ish. It's a big company. it's certainly one of the bigger companies that I've been in terms of shows. And it's pretty involved all throughout. A lot of our ensemble covers principals. A lot of us have like done different cover things in the past. We have a really awesome team of swings and understudies that also are really incredible. And I think also make the show what it is and bring such new life to it. And also save us whenever we're like really, our onstage company members are really down for the count. It really is quite wonderful. I think I've never been part of a cast that feels so lovely to each other. It's really weird to explain because I've never been part of a company that is this close. We all generally get along pretty well. We all hang out like all the time. A lot of times it's like, where are we all going? All 30 of us squeezing into whatever bar it is. It's very communal. And I really appreciate that, especially because tour life can be really isolating. This is my first tour and it's the longest I've ever been away from home. And that was really hard the first 6 months. The first 6 months I had spent my first Thanksgiving alone, not alone, but without my family, my first Christmas without my family. I was in Toronto and I was like, this has never happened to me before. I don't know how I'm supposed to navigate this. And the people of the cast and the company were so loving and were so understanding of, you know, me being a young 20-something on their first contract away from family. And I think we all understand how hard it is to be away from our loved ones. And so we lean on each other a lot. Especially because the show is so physically demanding, vocally demanding, emotionally demanding. We give a lot to the show and on the stage. And so I think there has to be some sort of support off the stage. Otherwise, we can't show up for each other on stage. And it makes it that much harder to be able to give our full selves. There are even times when I feel like I'm exhausted from the show and I try to go maybe try to reserve some energy, and it's kind of hard to find that balance just based on how it's structured. And so it's really helpful to have people in your corner that are understanding the place, the position that you're in, and that are ready to like joke around, or that are ready to be like, hey, I think you need some space. I'm going to give you some space, or vice versa. And then we circle back and then we're like, okay, what are we doing after the show? You know, it's a really great community and I'm really blessed to have it.
Yeah. Well, how long have you been on this tour and how long does it go for? Do you know?
I have been on the Moulin Rouge tour for about 2 years, actually, coming up.
Oh,
I started rehearsals in late May of 2024. My first show was on July 13th, 2024. And yeah, it's weird that it's been 2 years. Also, because my birthday is on July 14th, actually. And so this will be my third birthday with Moulin Rouge, which is kind of crazy. Like, it really is wild. We actually only have a few more weeks on tour. Our last performance will be August 2nd in Boston, which is where the tour opened. So it's a very fun moment. And I'm not sure that I think in just the joining the tour of it all and not knowing kind of how these contracts work, when I first came in, I wasn't sure how long I was going to be on here for. And, you know, different opportunities come and go. But this job, I think, has been really a really incredible, like, first big gig. So I feel really blessed to be able to close it out and to be able to like kind of wrap up this journey, this part of the journey, because Moulin Rouge the tour has been out for at least 4 years. And I feel like it's a really cool legacy to be part of, particularly the touring production and the touring company. Seeing everyone from like past versions of the tour come back and like do the tour again, it kind of drives a nice like through line. Even if I don't necessarily know the people that came before me super well, there is sort of like a connection there, at least to be like, hey, we've done the same thing, even if it's on a different stage, in a different state, sometimes in a different country, which is also the cool thing about Moulin Rouge is that it spans kind of everywhere. There's so many different companies around the world. And
no kidding.
I feel really blessed to be a part of the touring cast and to have met the people I've met on my 2 years here.
Well, have you ever counted how many songs are actually in this thing? Has anybody like racked that up?
I have not counted, but I believe it's written down somewhere as like 72 or 75. And it's not full songs, but it's like at least references to songs in the show itself. And yeah, and I'm reminded of how many songs are in the show whenever I'm at a grocery store, at a club, at a drag brunch, at whatever it is. A song from Moulin Rouge will probably play at least once, if not like several songs in a night or in a day. And it's so interesting. I even learned new songs that I had not known before joining the tour. And I remember like hearing them outside of the tour and being like, that's the name of that song? I had no idea. Did not know that. But yeah, it's a lot of music. It's a lot of
music. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite?
I have several favorite, like, medleys. One of my favorites is Diamonds. Diamonds, or it's called the Sparkling Diamond, but we call it Diamonds on the show. And it starts with Diamonds by Shirley Bassey, which I've heard that song since I was a kid, since I was, like, 5. But it also goes into, like, Single Ladies and Brick House and In Vogue. And I think it's so... It's such a smart mashup of songs that it really, like, feels cathartic to listen to. It's one of my favorite parts of the entire show. It's so glitzy. It's so glamoury. It's so fierce. Another one of my favorites is Bad Romance. That's our, or Backstage Romance, as it's formerly known. And it's our, like, Lady Gaga mix of a bunch of different songs about love, about, like, rocky love, about, like, love that's kind of, like, I don't know if toxic is the right word, but that's kind of, you know... fun and, like, testy. It's also, like, our high energy opener of Act Two, and it's such a fun dance piece that we get to perform and getting to sing. I've never been in a show where I get to sing Lady Gaga and Beyonce and Whitney Houston in the same show, which I think is pretty cool. Do I have any favorites? I'd say those are my top two for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm talking with Reese Carr. How did you get into acting and singing?
I've always been a very musical kid. I've always been mm-hmm. a kid that likes to move. I've, like, put on little plays with, like, my family. I'd make them be involved in little stories I would do. And I am also, like, a Disney kid. And so I watch Disney Channel all the time. And a lot of those channels, like Disney, Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network, a lot of them had a lot of actors who sing on their shows and in their movies. And so I think I was heavily influenced by that. I was heavily influenced by America's Best Dance Crew on TV. I was heavily influenced just by, like, watching movies and watching people perform. And I started, actually, I didn't start dancing until I was 13. My brother was a sports kid. And so because he was in sports, it was easy to put me in sports too. But even in the sports that I was in, I did soccer for about 6 years. I did karate for about 6 years. And even during both of those, I would be dancing and singing, like, on the sides. I was never truly as focused as I could have been. And even as I got better at them, I was still in the back of my mind, like, but I really want to, like, dance. Like, I really want to take ballet. I want to take jazz. I want to take tap, hip hop, all that stuff. I was lucky that I got to do a lot of theater, even in the times of me doing soccer and karate. I did my first show. I was, I think, a tree in a play in elementary school in the third or second grade. And I think as soon as I did that, I was like, we're going to do this more. And I did a lot of elementary school growing up. I did a lot of summer theater in my community theater, my hometown, Ohio Valley Summer Theater. Also, I worked with ABC Players, which is in Nelsonville, Ohio, which is 30 minutes away from Athens, Ohio. I'm from Athens, Ohio. And it became a habit, really, when I was younger, of doing every summer I would do a show. From about sixth grade up until high school, and then when I went to university, I would be doing a show every summer. And that was just kind of what you did. And I remember after I graduated high school, I didn't do a show that summer because I was like, I want to have a free summer. And it felt weird. It felt really strange to take that part out of it for a little bit. I think it was worth it, but theater has been part of my life for such a long time. And even outside of shows, Ohio Valley Summer Theater did this theater camp every summer. And for a few years, I attended the camp. And then I got to an age where I was a counselor at the camp. And I've had a lot of mentors in my life from Athens that have really shaped who I am as a performer. Whether it's dance, acting, or singing, they've all been in my corner. And I'm really appreciative of that. I think it can be hard being from a small town sometimes, especially moving to New York, where, you know, everyone is also the big fish in their small pond. Or they've had more experience in certain ways. Athens is a very small town. And so there was a while where I was maybe a little bit embarrassed to be fully transparent, or a little bit like, do I have enough of what it takes? And I think what I love about coming back to Athens is I am reminded that, like, all of those memories and all of the things that I've been through and all of the experience I've had is still so completely valid and has gotten me to where I am today. And I actually have nothing but the utmost respect and gratitude for my mentors that have gotten me here and that have given me tips and that have taught me certain things and that have pushed me. I feel like I was so pushed in my younger theater experience because I think maybe some of my mentors saw something I didn't quite see, and that I'm really appreciative of because I think it really has set me up for success in my adult life.
Yeah. Well, you went to Ohio State and it says that you were first class for musical theater.
So actually, I went to Ohio University.
Ohio University. Sorry.
Yes. No, it's okay. It's okay. Oh, that happens so much. Ohio State's the red one. Ohio University is the green one.
Okay. Yeah, no, I who knew? But Ohio University. And it was the first time that they offered that program. Is that right?
Yes. Coincidentally enough, I don't know why fate works in mysterious ways. It was in my senior year of high school, my voice teacher, who Ohio University has like a vocal program for non-university students. That's like for like kids and K through 18. And I was in that program for about 4 years from freshman year to senior year. And my voice teacher, Melissa Brobeck, she told me, hey, there's a musical theater program that's starting right when you graduate. I know you want to go to New York. I know you want to go to a bigger school maybe, but this program's right here. You'd be a part of the first class. That's a pretty iconic opportunity. And for a while, I was resistant as someone who had grown up in Athens and was born there. I was really in need of some change. However, looking back, I think it was maybe the best decision I could have made at the time, both financially and like emotionally. I met some of my best friends at that school. I've met some amazing colleagues that I can also call mentors now. And it was really interesting to be the first class of an inaugural program. In a lot of ways, we set the precedent for what to do and what not to do in the program. I think in a lot of ways, we went through a lot of changes that were really hard. We also were in the midst of the pandemic in our second year of the program. And that was a whole thing to figure out, like, how do we teach this in this way when we hadn't done this part of the program in person before, let alone on Zoom? And how do we do a show on Zoom? How do we navigate this all through the pandemic? And then coming out of it, I think it was even more so like, what can we do to make this better? And how can we make this program something that we can really feel proud of? And also accepting that we can only do so much with the time we've been given, but we can leave some sort of like legacy. And yeah, it was a really interesting time of my life. But I do look back on it fondly, even in the times when it was really difficult. I had a lot of really great friends that I could lean on, and I had a lot of really great community that we created. And I still talk to a lot of them to this day. I'm actually going to a friend's wedding from that program in September in London, which I'm very excited about. Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Well, you know what, Reese, I noticed that you use they, them pronouns. So you identify as non-binary. Can you tell me a little bit about how you landed there?
Yeah. So I, as a kid, I've always knew about I was special. And I think in terms of sexuality, I always knew that I was on the gay side of things. And I think it was more so a matter of coming to terms with that rather than like a, whoa, like a realization. And I think as it pertains, so I came out when I was 15. And I think in my head, I was kind of like, okay, that feels like it. I think, you know, I feel pretty solid in my gender. I always kind of knew that was a lie, I guess. Or even if it wasn't a lie, I was like, I don't know if that's the end of the story. And so out of high school, going into college, I had several trans friends. I had several non-binary friends. And so I had a decent understanding of what that meant. I guess for a while, I didn't think it really applied to me. However, looking back, now that I am 24, almost 25, I have always found gender to be something that I don't feel like I've subscribed to, at least as it is right now in the United States and in 2026. Someone asked me recently, actually, a dear friend had asked me if I see my gender as like all consuming genders or like no gender at all. And I told them it's actually a secret third thing. I don't know. I just feel like my personality transcends gender, and I don't feel like I really want to be constricted by whatever a man is supposed to be or a woman is supposed to be, or even what we say non-binary is. I think a lot of times non-binary can be categorized into a third gender, when I think the reality is that there doesn't need to be a restriction on how many there can be. I think for me, I love the opportunity to just exist. And for me, with my pronouns, they, them, theirs, I came to that realization, I believe it was like after my 21st birthday. I had tried for a summer to just use they, them pronouns. I had been playing with they, he, they for a while. And I was kind of like, the he just doesn't feel right. It just doesn't feel authentic. And I think the part that I try to remind people, I think, is that I'm still figuring it out. And a lot of queer people are still figuring it out and are oftentimes questioning themselves. But at the end of the day, I realized that I think my gender identity just feels in another space and in somewhere that I don't really feel the need to like subscribe to one or the other or any. I think especially when it comes to fashion and like self-expression for myself, I've always been on the more feminine side of things, and that feels really comfortable for me. And I've realized I'm at like a point in my life where it really does not make sense to not live authentically and express myself fully and to the fullest extent. And I think the fullest extent is like beyond gender and beyond like everyday comprehension. So yeah, I think as soon as I came to that realization, I was like, this feels like home. I think we found a place to play and a place to really feel safe and a place that I feel most like myself. And even times where I'm like, was that the right choice? I am like verified by something else that like, no, I made the right choice. And not that it was a choice. I think I made the right choice by listening to what my gut was saying and listening to what my internal rhythm was saying and to what I really wanted. And yeah, I feel really, really confident in that.
Yeah. Well, this tour is obviously wrapping up. Do you have anything lined up next, or are you just kind of auditioning?
It's auditioning, also kind of like relaxing for a little bit.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's been a great journey. It's also been a very long and straining journey on my voice and my body. And it's the longest contract I've ever done, certainly of this caliber. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how my body and my just me acclimates to not doing Moulin Rouge every day, sometimes twice a day. As much as I am nervous about the unknown, I can't lie, it definitely does scare me a little bit, not knowing what the future holds. I'm also excited. I've actually made a list of things I would like to do post-tour that I'm like super excited for. I'm really excited to grow out my hair because I used to have like longer hair before I joined the tour, and then I cut it before I auditioned, and that's what they stuck with. I'm excited to get back into roller skating. I used to roller skate and I was going to get into it, and then I moved and then there was just no time. I want to learn how to DJ. I really want to learn how to DJ. I feel like I'd be very good at it. And I just want to create more. I feel like I've been kind of in a creative slump as of late because I use so much of my energy in the show that I don't always have enough left in the tank. And before I joined the tour, I remember I was choreographing so much more and I just had all these ideas. And I'm really excited to return to that and to return to like singing more often for fun and like collaborating with friends and collaborating on like shows and readings and seeing shows and readings. And yeah, and then eventually, like later down the line, I want to get a cat. There are just things that like are just hard to do on tour. So
yeah, a cat is hard on tour.
Yeah. So I'm super excited to be able to like come into a new chapter, to close this chapter and to start a new one. And whatever that chapter is, I'm curious about, even if I'm a little scared.
I think that's normal. Well, Rhys Carr, Moulin Rouge comes as part of the Broadway at the Hobby Center July 14th through the 19th. I am so excited to see you on the stage and to see what all you do and all the razzle dazzle. It's certainly a spectacular. It lives up to the hype for sure. So break legs and we'll see you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. This is fun.
Thank you.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Hi, I'm Dan Spencer, KPFT listener, supporter, and volunteer for over 30 years. KPFT's mission is to provide community access to the airwaves. I support storytelling on the air, done by listener volunteers. Short stories, poetry, and books to engage and entertain. We need a break from the hard, real world to let our minds be soothed with other thoughts. Let KPFT lead the way to happiness.
We love hearing from our listener sponsors. KPFT is only possible because of small donations from listeners just like you. Become a member today by calling 713-526-5738 and choose option 1. or visit kpft.org to make a secure donation. Thanks for supporting your community radio station, 90.1 KPFT.
Listen in to the new KPFT 90.1 FM Wednesday lineup. Starting from midnight to 2:30, it's Casa de Casa. From 2:30 to 5 a.m., Brainstorm. And from 10 to 10:30 a.m., the new program, Leader Chicks. All on KPFT 90.1 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
Hey, this is Rodney Crowell, and if you're hearing me right now, you're listening to KPFT Radio. It's radio with a heart. I love KPFT Radio, always have. They've been around for so long, 50 plus years, and they've been bringing